Hey, hockey fans. Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
Chapter 1 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Ben Tucker. Chapter 1. He stopped when he saw the ambulance, a tall and stately old machine painted green and gray with discreet side curtains, and a uniformed driver at the wheel, parked with two wheels straddling the curb on a narrow alley off Bolton Lane. It was magnificently respectable, that antique Rolls-Royce with its purring engine, more respectable than the driver, down whose beefy red face a trickle of sweat poured from under a blue uniform cap to lose itself in a tight white collar. That was nearly noteworthy in itself, a trickle of sweat on a chilly London morning, with the sun hidden behind a bank of racing gray clouds. Carlos decided to watch. Two uniformed attendants brought down the sick man. He seemed very sick indeed, with his face the color of lead, and his eyes rolling in their sockets like blue marbles in a child's toy. The attendants supported him, and a third walked in front carrying the man's briefcase. They brought him toward the ambulance, almost carrying him, and his legs bent foolishly beneath him like the legs of a drunk or a drug user. Carlos watched in idle fascination. Sickness interested him. He was mildly inclined toward hypochondria. During the long watches aboard ship, he sometimes imagined himself catching some new and unheard-of disease. Then the great men of the Ford or Rockefeller foundations would want to study him. The disease would not hurt. It would be a slow and mysterious thing, quite unknown to science. They would give him a private room in a great white hospital in New York, let him have anything he wanted, and three times a week they would take samples of blood, urine, and saliva, and ask him questions. How did he feel? What exactly were his sensations, his state of mind, his reactions?
"Now then, move along now," the foremost attendant said. "No reason to stand here and gawk. Move along, move along."
Carlos had watched many ambulances in his time and had observed ambulance attendants of various nationalities. Invariably, they were incurious and uncaring, indifferent to the crowd around them as long as it didn't interfere with their work. The idea of an ambulance man asking him, one of four spectators, to move along was interesting. Perhaps the patient's disease was contagious?
"Move along," the attendant repeated. "Give the poor chap a chance to breathe."
The other spectators left. Carlos was on the point of leaving also. Then he looked at the ambulance driver. The man was staring at him, and anxiety was apparent on his sweating red face. Carlos looked again at the sick man, now being lifted into the back of the ambulance. In those glazed blue eyes, he thought he recognized something he had seen often in a business way, the sick inward stare of a man with an overdose of narcotics.
"I told you to clear out," an attendant said.
He was a big man, standing head and shoulders taller than Carlos, the briefcase gripped tightly in his right hand, his left hand raised to strike.
"Get out of here!"
Then Carlos knew what was going on. He knew it even without the sick man, making a despairing half-turn, croaking,
"Listen, get somebody."
Two attendants pushed him into the ambulance. The man with the briefcase swung his fist at Carlos, and at the same time, there was a wink of blued steel from the direction of the driver. Carlos ducked under the attendant's clumsy blow and jabbed him neatly in the stomach, a knife man's thrust without the knife. The man doubled over, gasping, and the briefcase dropped from his hand. Carlos scooped it up, knowing that it had to contain something valuable. Jewels, perhaps? Currency? Heroin? The attendants dropped the sick man and came after him. Carlos was already 20 yards down the street, sprinting hard, the briefcase clutched to his chest, a huge grin on his face. Two men lumbered behind him, but he ran 3 steps for their one down the deserted early morning streets into a warren of twisting alleys near London Dock. He shook them off as he had shaken off police in Tampico and Veracruz. No man with excess meat on his bones could catch him. Hunger and work had pared him down to a runner's condition. Heavy lifting had expanded his lungs. He outran the attendants with ease, slowed to a rapid walk on Trench Street, and returned to his boarding house. Now he carried the briefcase hidden under his draped overcoat. He was still grinning. There must be riches inside, for past a doubt he had interfered with a carefully planned robbery. A beautiful robbery. But they had only themselves to blame. It took steady nerves for that sort of thing, and those men had not been steady. End of chapter 1. Chapter 2 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This LibriVox recording's in the public domain. Chapter 2. She was sleepy and more than a little indignant at the treatment she had received. No amount of British good manners could make up for that. They were very polite, all of them, but they wouldn't let her go back to her hotel. She reached into her purse for a cigarette and found only an empty pack. That did it. She got to her feet and walked to the sergeant's desk.
"Sergeant, will you please take my statement now?"
"I'm very sorry, Miss Bellows. I couldn't do that."
She contained the explosion she could feel building in her.
"Just why couldn't you do that?"
The sergeant began telling her some nonsense about the division of duties in the London Constabulary. It confirmed all her ideas of the stupidity of officialdom. When she had gone to Mexico for her divorce, the officials had been just as devastatingly polite, just as implacably unreasonable. They had told her, "No, madam, the matter has been represented to you wrongly. Perhaps in the border towns they grant an immediate decree, but here in Morales, in the federal district..." Still, she had succeeded at last in getting her divorce, and past a doubt she would succeed soon in making her statement to the police and being allowed to leave. Really, it was so simple. She had witnessed a robbery, just that. She had seen it from the window of her hotel room in the gray hours of dawn, while she had been smoking a cigarette alone with her insomnia. An ambulance had arrived in the street below, and two attendants had brought down the patient. Then a badly dressed little man had appeared, argued with one of the attendants, snatched a briefcase, and run away. She had come down as soon as she could. Ambulance and patient were gone. Finding a use for her insomnia for once, and filled with an absurd sense of civic virtue, she had asked directions to the nearest station house, had gone there and told what she had seen. They had been very solicitous at first. The sergeant had offered her tea. A lieutenant named Davis had started to take down her statement, just as it would have done in the States. Then, halfway through, Davis had begun his incomprehensible behavior.
"Well, then, who is going to take my statement?"
"The right person is on his way, Miss Bellows."
"How long will that take?"
"He should be here momentarily."
The right person. My God, these British and their sense of propriety. When Lieutenant Davis had heard the address of the robbery, he had stopped, consulted a map, thumbed through a list on the sergeant's desk, then made a telephone call. To the right person. Well, his sense of propriety hadn't stopped him from staring covertly at her legs. They were very good legs. All of her was proportioned nicely in what she considered a neat imitation of a woman. She had a sweep of blonde hair the color of dark honey. It framed and softened her square, hard, attractive face with its aggressive jaw and bitter, beautiful lips. Her eyes were blue and wary, the hopeful, disillusioned eyes of an unbeliever. Now there was movement at the station house door. Apparently the right person had arrived. He walked directly to her.
"Miss Bellows, I'm Stephen Dane. I'm very sorry you had to wait. If you'll come this way, I think we can use the lieutenant's office."
He was tall and dark-haired, quite attractive in an aquiline sort of way. She rose and followed him. It seemed odd that the right man, from his accent, was an American. She asked for identification, and he showed her very briefly a paper with an illegible signature, stating that Stephen Dane was on assignment with the Central Intelligence Agency for an indefinite period of time. The paper did not say what section or department he was working with, nor did it state the purpose of his assignment. 15 minutes later, Dane had taken down her statement, and 5 minutes after that she was looking at photographs of numerous villainous-looking men in an attempt to identify the thief. No one in the police files looked very much like him. Then, strangely enough, Dane asked her to identify the ambulance men. That interested her. It made the whole thing sound like a deliciously complicated conspiracy. She was unable to find their photographs, and Dane asked her to describe, to the best of her ability, the appearance of the thief.
"He was short," she told Dane. "Badly dressed, either tanned or dark-skinned. He looked Latin, or perhaps Asiatic."
She thought for a moment.
I think his nose was rather large, and he was grinning when he ran with the briefcase.
I imagine he was, Dane said.
What did he steal?
Oh, we aren't quite sure yet.
She chose to ignore the tactful evasion. You mean you prefer not to tell me?
Dane smiled at her and shrugged his shoulders. That amused her for a moment. This Stephen Dane was so perfectly the young government man whose history was written bold upon his forehead. In college he must have been an excellent student, especially in politics and languages. And yet, despite his respectable intellectual achievements, he was surely a he-man on the popular FBI model, quick with his fists, adept at weapons, powerful despite his lean frame. And as though this weren't enough, Dane was obviously discreet, close-mouthed, modest, and even ironic. What a monolithic spectacle. What a terror. She had always known that men of this sort must exist, just as idiots and dwarfs must exist, but that didn't diminish her surprise at being faced with one.
"Could you tell me," she asked, "why the London police felt it necessary to call in an American CIA man on this robbery?"
"An American was robbed," Dane told her. She was growing angry. He must think she was a child to give out a story like that. At times it was flattering to be considered a child, but not now.
"Mr. Dane, you are being deliberately evasive about this whole thing. What's the big mystery?"
"No mystery at all," Dane said. He stood up. "I think that's all we need you for at the moment, Miss Bellows. Could we contact you later to look at some Interpol photographs?"
"I don't see why I should be bothered. There were other people in the street. Someone else must have gotten a look at your thief."
"We've talked to several people who were in the vicinity," Dane said, "but they had all left before the actual robbery took place. None of them really noticed the thief."
"That makes me an important witness," Dane nodded. "But to an unimportant crime."
Dane nodded again, not willingly. She smiled at him very pleasantly.
"You know the name of my hotel, Mr. Dane. I'll probably be there for a day or two longer."
She turned quickly and left, not quite content with her exit line. End of chapter 2. Chapter 3 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 3. He was a large man in his mid-50s, dressed in a Seville row suit and a quiet necktie. By sheer force of personality, he managed to make that suit look like a monument to an effete and doomed way of life. When in England, he wore Seville row as a silent, almost incomprehensible insult to the West. His face was broad and intelligent, but with no sign of a suspect intellectualism. His fingers were long for a man of his build, and almost sensitive. He made them look stumpier by clipping the nails straight across. He sat across the desk from the ambulance man, his hands folded quietly in front of him, his large head immobile on its thick neck, his eyes cast down. In his youth he had learned the value of words. More recently he had discovered the huge value of silence. He let the silence swell now as the head ambulance attendant finished his story.
"That's exactly how it happened, Mr. Bardief. It was so unexpected, so irrational."
Bardief smiled briefly. He had his own theories about the nature of the irrational.
"We chased him, of course, but the man was too quick. After losing contact, we thought it best..."
"You thought?"
Bardief asked, and noted the reaction. It was old habit with him to touch chords that evoked fear. The proper fear in others could mean security for oneself.
I'm very sorry, Mr. Bardief."
"Your sorrow does not concern me. Would any of you recognize the man if you saw him again?"
They nodded swiftly, scenting a reprieve.
"Go to the file room. Mary will show you the photographs. See if he is among them. And send Zettner in."
Bardief smoked half a cigarette. Then Zettner entered with the air of a surgeon dispassionately ready to perform an autopsy. Zettner was young, dedicated absolutely, and therefore lacking in a certain flexibility. He was good-looking, really a handsome young man, but the impression he gave was of a rigid asexuality. His cold pleasure lay in abstractions, plans, schemes, ideas, concepts, anything that could be divorced from flesh and blood. The ambulance and the hypodermic needle had been his device. He had counted on qualities he had read about in books. The phlegmatic disposition of British crowds, the acceptance of an ambulance anywhere, at any time at all. Zettner's plans were always of the nature of set pieces. Their usual success had to be ascribed in the final analysis to man's indifference to artificialities thrust into his environment. Zetner heard about the capture and subsequent loss of the briefcase with a calmness that bordered on indifference. His bent was statistical. He didn't allow himself to worry about momentary loss or gain. Still, he agreed with Bardief that the contents of the briefcase had an importance in their own right.
"I have a feeling," Bardief said, "that we will not find the man's photograph."
He smiled faintly, remembering Zetner's distaste for intuitions.
"Assuming this to be the case, what do you propose we do?"
Zetner considered. "The man will have to dispose of the contents. There are only a few markets for such goods. We will watch for the man, and keep an even closer watch on the markets."
"Very good," Bardief said. "What do you think of our chances?"
"The success or failure of any one enterprise?"
"No, no," Bardief said. "We must not think in such long terms, at least not at the moment. The briefcase is important. Do you think you can recover it?"
"Yes," Zetner said.
"What makes you think so?"
"I rely on the predictable stupidity of human beings."
"Fine," Bardief said. "Can you start immediately?"
Zetner rose and left the room without a word. He, too, had learned the value of silence. Bardief took out a handkerchief and mopped his forehead. He had helped shape the Zetners of the New World. Historical necessity had called for the birth of a generation of Zetners. But he couldn't help being uncomfortable in their presence. End of chapter 3. Chapter 4 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 4. Locked in the privacy of his room, Carlos put the briefcase on the nightstand, lighted a cigarette, and lay back luxuriously on the bed. Morning sunlight filtered through the dust on his window, and the briefcase glowed a deep cordovan. He admired the brass fittings. Their yellow wink hinted at ridges beneath the shining leather. For the moment, the hint was enough. Later, the contents of the briefcase would have to be converted, through dangerous and devious channels, into currency. God alone knew where that path would lead him. A briefcase worth the services of 4 men and an ambulance must contain riches indeed. Jewels, platinum, uncut heroin. But for the moment, he could be rich without opening the briefcase, lying on an unmade bed in a sailor's boarding house with £20 6 shillings in his pocket. Yes, for the moment he was rich. It was worth remembering. Carlos finished the cigarette at his leisure, then examined the briefcase. It was locked. He nodded approvingly. He tried to slit the leather with his pocket knife and encountered a sheet of steel beneath the cordovan. Better and better. A man doesn't buy a briefcase like that in order to transport his lunch in the morning paper. He turned to the lock. It was small but very strong, of a better steel than the blade of his knife. He cut back the leather and saw that the flanges of the lock were welded into the steel body of the briefcase. Excellent. From his jacket pocket he took an oilskin package, which he had found useful in many parts of the world. He removed 2 slender curved picks and went to work on the lock, with the delicacy of a man dissecting a butterfly. No delicacy sufficed for that lock. It was a superior creation, as was proper on a briefcase containing great riches. Carlos cut away the rest of the leather, exposing the bright steel case. He studied it carefully, turning it in the light so that he could examine the seam where the 2 halves came together. From his oilskin case he took a small chisel and placed it against the seam. He hammered with a heavy seaman's shoe, then looked. It barely dented the metal. The seam overlapped. There was no place to gain leverage. Carlos lighted another cigarette and scowled at the briefcase. His good humor had vanished. They had gone too far, the makers of this little safe. The damn thing looked as though it might have to be opened with a cutting torch, and if he did that, he might spoil the contents. He shook the case and heard a faint, dry rattle within it. Packets of heroin? Banknotes? He put the briefcase on the bed and tried to think. He needed help in order to open the damn thing. Someone with hammers, big chisels, perhaps even a cutting torch. But in all of England there was only one man he knew, John Adelgate, to whom he sold the packets of marijuana and heroin which he smuggled across from Mexico. Adelgate had not cheated him yet. Perhaps he could be trusted. But what share would he want simply for opening the briefcase? And could he be sure that the briefcase would be opened in his presence? If not, part of the contents could be easily removed, or the entire thing if it proved valuable enough. Here in Europe, Carlos had no friends. To trust Adelgate with a few packets of heroin was one thing, but to give him a metal briefcase worth at least the services of four men and an ambulance... No, by God, it was too big a risk. He had dreamed of this moment too long to entrust it now to a cold, fish-faced stranger. Ever since he had left his village and gone to Puerto Vallarta to work on the fishing boats. Longer than that. Since the time when he was a little boy playing in the dust of Santa Marta de la Mesa, he had dreamed of a time when he would have riches in his hand. In his own hand. Fabulous wealth. Thousands of dollars. Perhaps tens of thousands. He had feasted on that dream during the years of cutting sugarcane on the lands of the rich man from Mexico City, and afterwards working on the fishing boats of Puerto Vallarta, and still later stoker, oiler, steward on a succession of ships from Acapulco and Veracruz to many ports of the world. The dream had sustained him. That vision of independent wealth had helped him live through the filth of the world. Other men had their god, a remote stranger who saw everything and did nothing. Carlos had his dream. The wealth which buys freedom had obsessed him. Men from the north had told him, "Work hard, Carlos. Save. Improve yourself." But 1,000 years of thrift would not be long enough for a man of Santa Marta de la Mesa to become like the Americans of the north. Communists on board ship had talked to him with great earnestness. "Work for the people, Carlos. Remember Mexico's great revolutionary history. Fight for the day when all wealth and all means of wealth shall be distributed equally." They had talked well, those men, but they had not moved him. Very well to talk of the Mexican Revolution, but in Santa Marta, 2 babies out of 3 died soon after birth. And when the cane was cut and the money spent, the men of his village lounged in front of the cantina and tied their rope belts tighter. Perhaps in Russia they had indeed learned to share all the wealth. But if this were so, the Russians were a breed of men unlike any other men Carlos had seen on the face of the earth. No, the communists could be right. But a prudent man didn't care to wait so long. Better to get rich now and leave the Americans and the Russians to argue their incredible theories of human destiny. Carlos turned again to the briefcase and studied it with fierce concentration. His forehead was creased, and his eyes glowed beneath the shielding frontal bone of his brow. His wide lips were pursed in concentration. He ran a calloused forefinger around the rim of the briefcase, then lightly caressed the welded flanges of the lock. Truly good workmanship would have driven rivets in addition to the weld. He studied the weld with care, noting on one side tiny, almost invisible air bubbles. Kneeling on the floor, he braced the briefcase against an angle of floor and wall, and positioned the chisel against the welded flange. After a preliminary tap, he drove down hard with the shoe, then studied the effect. Nothing visible. He set the chisel at a corner of the flange and chopped hard with the shoe. From the floor below came a stern tapping on the water pipe. An outraged voice whined, "Here now, it's 7:30 in the morning." Carlos glanced to the bed where his knife lay folded. Then he struck against the flange 3 more times with great precision. "What in hell's the matter with you, bloody lunatic?" In the 4th blow, the flange and lock sheared neatly off the briefcase. A little more work with the chisel allowed him to pry the tongue off. The briefcase opened slightly. Moving to the bed, Carlos opened the hinged top and shook out the contents. Within, he found an opened packet of woodbines in a large brown manila envelope. The envelope was sealed. Stamped in red on both sides were the words, "Top Secret." That was unpleasant. The riches promised by the beautiful briefcase and the 4 men and the ambulance were already receding from view. Top Secret? He opened the envelope quickly, praying that it might still contain something of value. Inside was another brown envelope, slightly smaller, also marked Top Secret. This one had an address. American Strategic Planning Board for Carlisle Street, London, Southwest 3. Carlos ripped the envelope open, shuffled hastily through the papers inside, and dropped them. His disappointment was as painful as a knife thrust in the side. He wanted to cry, to hit his head against the wall. And only the fear of his complaining neighbor downstairs stopped him. After all the danger, the quickly summoned resolution, the magnificently performed action, after all the hope and all the promise, what did he have? A handful of American secrets. What a fool he had been to dream. The prize was gone, and he was left now only with the danger. Still, even in his acutest moment of disappointment, resolution did not fail him. The briefcase had to be disposed of. As for the papers, it would probably be best to burn them and pretend they had never existed. Only a fool involved himself with the government and its secrets, and Carlos was no fool. He gathered the papers together and glanced through them. They didn't seem to say very much, these top secrets. One page appeared to be a map of some kind, but nothing identified the land or the ocean. No towns were labeled. There was nothing except a neat pin tracing of what looked like a coastline. Some little black dots were scattered around the map. Little dots with numbers. Another page contained references for the numbers. But the references were all in groups of five-letter words, of no language he had ever heard of. A code? Certainly a code. There were more pages filled with these five-letter groups, and more pages of numbers, many numbers, some extremely big, some small, all with lettered references. This American top secret, Carlos thought, contained many little secrets. Very well, he told himself. Destroy the papers and forget the matter. He took a box of matches from his pocket and removed a single match. Then he began cleaning his nails with it. Perhaps he shouldn't be hasty. True, the briefcase hadn't contained jewels, platinum, heroin, dollars, or any of the other recognized forms of wealth, but it had contained a top secret. Someone had thought enough of that secret to hire four men and an ambulance. Just to perform the robbery must have cost someone several hundred dollars. What could this secret be worth? $1,000? $10,000? Were they worth anything, these pages written in code? He slapped his knee impatiently. Of course they were worth something. Governments were always buying secrets from spies, that was well known. And these secrets, twice stolen, should be worth more than most. In his anger at the lack of readily negotiable wealth in the briefcase, he had nearly allowed a potentially greater wealth to slip away. Secrets were valuable. And American secrets must be very valuable, since America was so rich a country. $10,000? These secrets might be worth 20 or even 30,000. The sensation of wealth had returned to him, and with it a sense of well-being. Soon there would be an end to meaningless work for too little money, to bad food and ugly women, to pointless existence among cold aliens. He would get money for the top secret, and with that money he would buy a farm in Australia, as far as he could get from America, Mexico, and Russia. He would pay for his farm in cash outright, and call no man his master. But how was he going to convert the top secret into money? That, he conceded, might be difficult. But the first step was obvious. He would go to John Adelgate, who disposed of anything of value. Doubtless he would have to haggle with Adelgate over a price, but at least there would be a price. He put the papers into the inside pocket of his jacket and hid the briefcase under his mattress. It was perfectly safe there. No one made up a room in the boarding house until the guest had signed out. He left at once, armed with his knife and his enthusiasm, and possessed of a nearly invincible ignorance as to what might lie ahead. End of chapter 4. Chapter 5 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 5. "All right," said Susan Bellows. "I've looked through about 10,000 of your smudgy photographs. What next?"
"That's it," Dane said. "These Interpol photos are copied from police files all over Europe. Unless you've made a mistake, his picture isn't on file with any of the European police."
"I haven't made any mistake."
"You're sure?"
"Of course."
But as she said it, she tried to find the thief's image in her mind. It lay there, blurred but distinct, indescribable except in generalities. Brown or tanned complexion, large nose, flat lips, bright dark eyes, black hair, a certain sureness about his bearing, but something a little desperate in that sureness. As she concentrated on it, the picture became dimmer. It wasn't really a picture, it was a key, waiting for the three-dimensional representation to initiate the process of recognition.
"I'd know him," Susan said. "Now what?"
"Now," Dane said, "I'd like to buy you a drink."
That's an offer I hardly ever refuse.
In a back room of the George V, they sat over squat glasses of scotch set on a gleaming mahogany table. The dusky twilight of the place invited confidences. They exchanged none. Dane seemed withdrawn into himself, morose, almost apathetic. His hands were quiet, and he gave the impression of being completely at ease. But Susan had the impression that this air of relaxation was not natural. It seemed to be imposed upon him, a man's idea of how he should react under stress. She asked,
"What will you do now?"
"Try to find him."
"You don't even know what he looks like."
"It isn't always necessary." She shook her head dubiously. Perhaps he knew what he was talking about, but to find one faceless man of Latin complexion in all of Europe. "What about you?" Dane asked.
"I shall continue my trip. Paris, Geneva, Vienna, Florence."
"It sounds like fun," Dane said.
"It's just great. Dane, aren't you going to tell me what was in that briefcase?"
"No."
"I can make a pretty good guess, you know."
"That's your concern."
"What if I talk about it?"
"There's nothing I can do about it." She didn't like his answer, and she resented being written off. After all, she was the only real witness to the theft. She pouted over her drink. Pouting was a thing she could do prettily, and looked up at Dane again.
"Isn't there any way I could help?"
Dane straightened in his chair. "There is, of course."
"Well, then?"
"No, you wouldn't like it. It would disrupt your travel plans."
"To hell with my travel plans. Chasing a thief sounds much more exciting than walking through art galleries."
"It could be dangerous."
"Then by all means include me in."
"Are you sure?"
"Yes, on condition that you tell me what was inside that precious briefcase. You know, we'll be colleagues, intrepid hunters of the desperate criminal. It wouldn't be fair if you didn't tell me."
Dane nodded. The briefcase contained an envelope marked Top Secret.
"And inside the envelope?"
"There was a top secret document."
"Dane, you aren't being fair. What was the document about?"
"I haven't been told."
"But it was important?"
"Extremely important."
"I don't see how we have any chance of recovering it," Susan said. "If the Soviets have it, can't it be sent to Moscow by diplomatic pouch?"
"That and other ways. But we're quite sure the Soviets don't have it. Those ambulance men were in Russian employ. The papers were stolen from them."
"I see," Susan said slowly. "But who could have stolen them, and why?"
"We have no way of knowing. But since we don't have the thief's face anywhere on file, it's reasonable to assume that he's new at the game. Either he's a freelance spy trying to break in, or he's employed by some other government. The first seems more probable under the circumstances. If so, he'll try to sell the plans."
"Can he get much for them?"
"A great deal," Dane said. "But not easily. Dealing in this sort of merchandise is tricky. We'll be lucky if we find him before someone kills him." Dane lighted a cigarette and thought for a moment. "If he is an amateur at this, then he's bound to make some mistakes. He might get away with a few, but there's very little margin for error in the espionage field. If he's smart and lucky, he'll contact us first and offer to sell the papers back."
"And if he contacts the Russians?"
Dane shrugged. "He might get a great deal of money, but they never pay for what they can take."
"I see," Susan said. "All right, what do we do now?"
"Nothing. We wait for something to happen."
"That might take a long time."
"Yes, it might."
"Won't we get bored?"
She looked directly at Dane and was a little shocked at the impact of his direct, grayish-green eyes. He was smiling faintly, very controlled. She wasn't sure if she liked it. He was probably the sort of man who thought he knew so damned much, who gave away nothing. "We'll try not to be bored," Dane said. The smile he gave her had a definite hint of lechery. She frowned automatically, thinking that this might be fun. End of chapter 5. Chapter 6 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This LibriVox recording's in the public domain. Chapter 6. Bingham Row at its upper end fought mightily for respectability. The lower end was beyond redemption, bordering as it did on the docks and catering cheerfully to sailors of 50 nationalities and half a dozen tastes.
But Upper Bingham Row was inhabited by ship's chandlers, chemists, greengrocers, and the like, who turned their faces resolutely and a little desperately away from the river, toward the apartments of clerks and semi-detached homes of family men. Passionately, Upper Bingham Row desired to join the bourgeoisie, and, in the proper light, succeeded. None on that narrow battlefield street fought so hard as John Adelgate of Adelgate's. Carlos came to Adelgate's with hope in his heart and secret papers in his pocket. He entered the dim little furniture store, and within seconds Adelgate himself appeared, small and moist like a man who had been reincarnated from a frog, with thin hair combed straight across a round head, with narrow forehead and a small supercilious nose, hands folded across a respectable little paunch, damp, knobby fingers interlocked, rosebud mouth pursed somewhere between genteel disapproval and businesslike desire. Conflict raged behind Adelgate's placid appearance. Cunning little respectability met the brute avarice daily in a 20-round battle. It was an overweight match, the burly defending champion far and away the favorite. But an interesting struggle was guaranteed all the same. Decision? An uneasy compromise, formed and reformed every day, expressed by defiant little mottos which crept across Mr. Adelgate's mind during the business hours. Selling heroin calls for a certain ingenuity in the construction of slogans. No worse than selling booze, is it? Strong drink is habit-forming, too, so it's just a question of what's legal. Users don't get violent like drinkers. Very quiet bunch, users. Nothing deadly about it, just withdrawal that's dangerous. And that's the fault of society. People need their bit of fun. The stuff does what alcohol promises. Chinese used to smoke opium like we'd down a pint. And just consider the Ming Dynasty. With these homely sayings, Mr. Adelgate tried to force friendship between nervous little respectability and the insensate brute avarice. He considered himself a monument to the success of this project. Adelgate said,
"Well now, Mr. Zichilia, and how are you today?"
"Very fine," Carlos said. Since he had left his village, no one had succeeded in pronouncing his name correctly. He had learned to recognize himself in many foreign approximations, none of them very close to the name he had been given in Santa Marta.
"And how are you, Mr. Adelgate?"
Adelgate had leaned forward somewhat anxiously to hear the reply. That was another disadvantage under which Carlos labored. He had grown up thinking that he spoke Spanish, but when in his teens he had journeyed to Puerto Vallarta, he had learned that the rest of Mexico didn't consider his language Spanish at all. It was a dialect, people told him, one of the tongues of the Aztecs, interspersed with mispronounced Spanish words. That had been a shock. At the age of 16, he had had to learn what the man of Mexico City and Veracruz called Spanish. On board ship, he had assimilated English with fair thoroughness. Any Spanish-American could understand his English, but foreigners leaned forward anxiously when he spoke, aimed an ear at him, asked him to repeat words, to speak a little slower, please. Some foreigners didn't understand his English at all, couldn't figure out what he was saying. He could express himself properly only in his dialect, and he would die rather than return to Santa Marta. He understood almost everything which a world of aliens said to him, but only a protracted acquaintance gave them the ability to understand him.
"Won't you come in the back, Mr. Zichilia, and have some tea?"
"Thank you very much," Carlos had learned to stomach the stuff. It was a minor ordeal through which one passed in order to conduct business.
"There we are now. Is that chair comfortable? Very good. A pleasant journey across, Mr. Zichilia."
At least this time he hadn't offered any of those things with the ugly name. Scones.
"Extremely glad to hear it, Mr. Zichilia. The weather here has been somewhat drier than usual. We are expecting a lovely summer. At least we have our hopes."
It rained enough in this city to irrigate all of Mexico.
"Now then, sir, I expect you have a little business you'd like to attend." "I have something to sell."
Although naturally ceremonious, the conventions of a dozen countries and a dozen Mr. Adelgates were too much for Carlos.
"Of course, Mr. Zichilia. I'm happy to say that the price per gram has stayed constant during your absence. If you will allow me to take out the scales." "No, Mr. Adelgate, it is not heroin."
Adelgate smiled. Jewels or platinum presented less of a problem to a vigilante conscience.
"It is a strange thing, but valuable, I think,"
Carlos said to the forward-leaning Adelgate. Then, speaking slowly and with much attention to his enunciation, which remained unremittingly Aztec, he told the story of the ambulance men and the top secret. Mr. Adelgate listened,
and not so much a battle as a skirmish took place in his mind. Stolen plans. How colorful. And it was not as though they were British plans. These belonged to the Americans, who, although allies, were not even in the Commonwealth. For a moment, Adelgate flirted with the romantic notion of acting as a middleman in this matter. But good common sense brought him to reason at once.
Please, Mr. Zatilia, say no more. I would be less than truthful if I didn't tell you that I have no experience in matters of this sort. No experience whatsoever. You will not sell them for me. My dear fellow, I have no notion whom to sell them to. Not the slightest. It's an entirely different sort of thing. A different world, you might say, from the world which I inhabit. Different. Of course, vastly different.
Mr. Adelgate paused. He understood very well his own everyday world of furniture and heroin. It had become a commonplace to him, ethically comparable to a good stiff drink at the corner pub. Users held no mystery for him. They were nothing more than drinkers of an illegal beverage which he sold in handy powdered form. Even jewels and platinum were matter-of-fact items to which an independent man resorted in order to escape the strictures of socialistic taxation. This was mundane. But what could he say to this foreigner about the romantic newspaper world of spies, plans, documents, secrets? He tried to explain, but embarrassment took hold of Mr. Adelgate. He sounded, he felt, like an Edgar Wallace thriller. Carlos was not embarrassed, since he never read. He asked firmly,
"Are these papers valuable?" "Well, I suppose they are,"
Mr. Adelgate said.
"Yes, I should certainly think they are." "I knew it. But, my dear fellow, you must still find a buyer." "That's true,"
Carlos said, his joy fading in the light of practical necessities.
"Someone must buy secrets like these. But one never knows who,"
Mr. Adelgate said.
"Then how do people sell secrets?"
Mr. Adelgate applied his business mind and practical knowledge of the world to the problem.
"The buyers must have an organization, just like any other business. Contact men..."
He remembered something from the war.
"They have men who buy drinks for sailors. Do you think if I went to the dockside bars?" No, that was only during wartime. I don't think they do it anymore."
They sat together in silence. Another slippery bit of information swam to the top of Mr. Adelgate's mind.
"There was a fellow in Amsterdam a few years ago. Van Joost, I believe his name was. Dealt in smuggled diamonds. But one of my customers said he was really a special agent."
Carlos raised both eyebrows.
"For whom?" "I don't believe my customer ever told me." "It doesn't matter. He is a man who buys secrets." "That's what my customer said, or at least he implied it. Understand, I've never met this Van Joost. I have no idea." "Could you give me his address?"
Carlos asked.
"I believe I have it here somewhere,"
Mr. Adelgate said. He began to shuffle through a pile of papers of assorted sizes and colors, rapidly at first, then more slowly. It had just struck him that he should receive some sort of middleman's commission for this service. And at the same time he realized that the raggedly dressed Carlos Zatia obviously didn't have the price of a commission on him. There were other objections to giving the address. Zatia was a foreigner, and therefore quite probably untrustworthy when taken from his normal sphere of business. He was an excitable fellow who might get into trouble, and if that happened, if he fell into the hands of the police, might he not wildly incriminate anyone who had had contact with him? Adelgate's fingers slowed still further at this thought. But the piece of paper with Van Joost written boldly on it had come to sight. Carlos seized it with a flashing smile. He studied it with care, since he read only with difficulty. "Van Joost, 17 de Ruyter's Cade, Amsterdam." He would remember it.
"Thank you very much, Mr. Adelgate,"
Carlos said, rising to his feet.
"I am extremely grateful to you. If I am successful, I hope to show my gratitude." "Oh, that's very decent of you. You will be careful." "Of course,"
Carlos said.
"Thank you." "Wouldn't want anything to happen to you,"
Mr. Adelgate said heartily, clapping Carlos on the shoulder. End of chapter 6. Chapter 7 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 7. Antaeus, the opponent of Hercules, drew his strength from Mother Earth.
Zettner would have liked to emulate that mythic socialistic archetype. But instead, his power came from an intellectual process in which the mind was projected selectively into the probable future. Now, with his plans formed and his orders given, he seemed to expand visibly before Bardief's eyes. Even his explanations had the faintest note of condescension, the tone of the planner to the mere builder. "I have sent out the ambulance men," Zettner said, "dressed in ordinary clothing, to four likely areas of London. There is a slight chance they will catch sight of the man. These are the areas I have selected." Zettner's strong, pale fingers moved decisively to different points on a wall map of London while he explained his reasons for selecting them. Bardief nodded. He had awakened that morning with a faint headache, a reminder of his old migraine. It intensified his natural distaste for his colleague. With an effort, he concentrated. "The ambulance men agree," Zettner said, "upon the spontaneous nature of the thief's action. Taking into account all the evidence, I think we can form a reasonable hypothesis about the character of the man."
"And what have you deduced about his character?" Bardief asked with wasted irony.
"The man is an asocial romantic, inclined toward a criminal opportunism. The theft arose fortuitously. He saw a chance for gain and seized upon it."
"Unless, of course, he was hired for the job."
"I considered that possibility. It would imply a major leak in our previously tight organization. Since it is the more cumbersome of the two hypotheses, I have discarded it for the moment."
"All right," Bardief said. "What else?"
"Assuming the correctness of my reasoning, the thief is a man without an organization. He will have to sell rather than deliver the papers he has stolen. That complicates his situation. His outlets in London are severely limited."
"He may try to use them anyhow," Bardief said.
"I thought of that and put a 24-hour watch on all known buyers not connected with us. This is a serious drain on our strength, but only a temporary one. I consider it justified by the seriousness of the event."
"Fine," Bardief said. "What if he doesn't try to sell the papers in England?"
But Zettner had thought of that, too. He assumed that the thief would soon leave the British Isles. This land of England, he pointed out, was gallingly restrictive to the sale of espionage work. The thief would find this out if he didn't know it already. He would want the wider scope and close frontiers of the continent. In expectation of this, Zettner had stationed men at key points on the more important exits from the country. The thief had a strong probability, however, of slipping past them unnoticed into France.
"And then?" Bardief asked.
Zettner smiled subtly.
"His apparent advantages on the continent are illusory. We have much greater organizational strength there, and less trouble with police interference. I have already contacted our people preliminary to an expected second phase of the operation."
"You seem to have covered everything," Bardief said, somewhat sourly.
"To the best of my ability, I have." After Zettner had left, taking his sanitary schemes with him, Bardief relaxed in an overstuffed armchair. That morning, the sight of Zettner's white, pure Grecian face had been nearly too much to bear. According to his dossier, Zettner did not smoke, drank very lightly, and was not inclined toward promiscuity. Using him as an example, there was really a great deal to be said against virtue. In a man past his 20s, it tended to become a vice. More and more of late, Bardief had fallen into the habit of reflection. Certain things never came under his observation. He found no reason to speculate on the immutable future of communism. Alternatives could be left to the fevered imaginations of bourgeois romantics. Instead, Bardief thought back on his army days, their simplicity and joy in a chaotic world. There had been a fierce pleasure then in the swift spread of Russian influence across Europe in the wake of the Red Army. Bardief sometimes wished he were still serving with his fellow officers. Perhaps they had been right, those who had survived the Germans and Stalin and had stayed in the army. Man's refuge lay in the following of simple orders: defend your country. That was a motto even a clever man could live with. But the difficulty and austere task of serving future generations taxed a man's strength and his dialectical ability, unless that man were a Zettner. And now? The conquest went on. But the countries of the West, forever tottering, refused to fall. They invented new stratagems, retained their pseudo-liberal governments, grouped the forces of left and right around them. Worse yet, they were beginning to make use of dialectics,
They were still clumsy at it. They preserved an affection for the unuseful truth. But they were beginning to use that supreme weapon. The end result, as Bardief saw it, would be a complete semantic confusion. And who then would know the truth? Which men would know their own minds? Only the Zetners, those triumphs of the will to conditioning. He wished he could have more affection for the demonstrable wave of the future. To know history, to serve it, that was one thing. But to feel affection for it was another. He sighed and turned to his work. Later that morning he was told that the thief had been seen at Victoria Station, but had been lost in the crowd. The ambulance men were redeployed to cover the most likely ports of exit from England. During the same day, Dane received his first piece of definite information. A witness had come voluntarily to New Scotland Yard, had been interrogated briefly, and taken to Dane's temporary office at Central Intelligence. A CID sergeant brought in the man's record, which Dane studied quickly. It was followed 15 minutes later by the man himself. The witness was small and moist, nervous, pudgy, obsequious, and faintly at home in authoritarian surroundings. An odor of furniture polish trailed him and clung affectionately to the chair upon whose edge he sat.
"The fact of the matter is," said Mr. Addlegate, "I considered it my duty to report this matter to the proper authorities. The police have assured me that I will not, that previous indiscretions."
Dane assured him that his previous indiscretions would not be held against him.
"Well, then, sir, I suppose you might as well know that at one time I was engaged in what they call the drug traffic."
Dane raised both eyebrows in an expression of faint surprise.
I got out of it, of course, as soon as I realized it was wrong. I'm in furniture now."
He looked up hopefully. Dane smiled and indicated that he well knew how anyone could suffer a brief lapse from the strict letter of the law.
Yes, sir, and of course from time to time people still approach me, foreigners and the like, thinking I'm still in the racket. It's a damnable nuisance, but I can't very well post a sign, can I?"
Dane agreed that such a situation could indeed be an embarrassment, to say nothing of other difficulties.
"That's exactly it, sir. Other difficulties. Criminals, Mr. Dane, enforce their own sort of law. The position of a man like myself is not easy."
Dane could understand that. He offered Mr. Addlegate a cigarette. Addlegate accepted it, wondering if he had set the groundwork of his story properly. The American seemed a pleasant sort, quite possibly with influence. To judge from his manner, the foundation of the story was well laid. A modest confidence came over Mr. Addlegate.
That being the case, sir, you can understand that it was not exactly an unusual thing for me when this sailor fellow came to my shop this morning. I expect he was like the others, a foreigner, who had picked up a packet of narcotics somewhere, and had heard scurrilous rumours that I could dispose of it for him. I prepared to eject him as quickly and quietly as possible.
"A sailor?" Dane asked.
"I believe he said he was a sailor."
"Did he give any name?"
"I'm afraid he didn't."
Mr. Addlegate had decided to withhold this piece of information, since it argued a suspicious degree of intimacy with the man. "Do you know what his nationality was?"
I couldn't say for certain, sir. Spanish or Italian, or one of those places."
Dane nodded. Sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Addlegate. Just tell me the story as it occurs to you."
Yes, sir. Well, sir, it was the most extraordinary thing. Instead of offering me narcotics, I would have given him a short shrift then, he wanted to sell me secrets. American secrets, he said. I was taken aback."
"That's very understandable."
Yes, I was caught quite off guard."
Addlegate hesitated for a moment. The difficult part of the story was coming, the part which had to be told in just the right way.
"When I told him I didn't buy anything except furniture, the fellow demanded an address from me. He more than demanded, he threatened Mr. Dane. I confess I was frightened. He was a little man, but extremely muscular, as sailors frequently are. Furthermore, he carried a knife, and I was unarmed."
"Nasty situation," Dane murmured.
"It was indeed. The fellow was getting ugly, so I gave him the first address I could think of. A man in Amsterdam by the name of Van Joost. Van Joost used to be in narcotics, so I'm told, but I gave the sailor his address simply because it came to mind. If I had thought a little faster, I would have given him a fictitious name."
"Oh, this way is much better," Dane said.
"Is it? I'm awfully glad you think so, sir. When the sailor left, I sat down to think out my position. It wasn't simple, you understand. Criminals, particularly if they're organized, can be every bit as powerful as the law, or at least so I've heard. It wasn't as though I were a completely innocent shopkeeper.
Mr. Addlegate smiled ruefully.
I've had a bit of trouble in my time.
Luckily, Dane said, that's all over and done with.
Oh, yes, sir, I thought it out, and at first I'm ashamed to say I considered simply not speaking about it. But other considerations moved me. Suppose the idiot were caught. Wasn't he likely to involve me in the wretched affair? I didn't like the idea, and I didn't like the idea of American secrets being stolen, we being allies and all. I mean, we're all in this together, aren't we?
We certainly are, Dane said. Do you remember Mr. Van Joost's address?
Oh, I've written it down here. 17 de Ruyter's Cade, Amsterdam.
What did the sailor look like? Mr. Addlegate gave a somewhat vague description of Carlos. Is there anything else you can remember? Anything at all? Mr. Addlegate thought for a moment, then shook his head. He had said exactly what he had planned to say. Dane said, I can't thank you enough, Mr. Addlegate. Would you mind repeating your statement to a stenographer?
Not at all, sir, not at all. I expect he'll be an easy man to catch. How he came upon those secrets, I have no idea. But he seemed a simple-minded, impetuous sort of chap. Even without my information, you'd probably have him in no time.
Dane again expressed his thanks and led Mr. Addlegate to a stenographer's desk. On the way, Mr. Addlegate asked,
I don't suppose there's any reward posted? Not that was my purpose.
Dane said that no reward had been set, but if Addlegate's information proved at all useful, he would definitely receive compensation. Pleased, Addlegate sat down to dictate his statement, and Dane returned to his office. After contacting police headquarters in Holland, Dane booked 2 tickets on an evening flight to Amsterdam. End of chapter 7. Chapter 8 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 8.
Now this, she said, is a very lovely room, and the price includes breakfast.
Carlos nodded. He looked past the pink bulk of the landscape into the tiny, scrupulously clean rectangle of the room.
It has a view, she added.
Carlos was busy converting guilders into dollars in his head. His cash reserves were running low. Less expensive rooms could be found near the docks, but this room looked out on de Ruyter's Cade, within viewing distance of Joost's store.
I like a room with a view, Carlos said. I think I will take it.
I beg your pardon, the landlady said. Oh, you'll take it. Excuse me, have you been speaking English very long?
Not very long, Carlos said gloomily.
I didn't think so. I have no trouble understanding my English guests and Americans, too, when they speak slowly. Are you from South America?
From Chile,
Carlos said on the spur of the moment.
All that way. Is Chile very lovely?
Carlos nodded. He knew hardly anything about South America.
The mountains are very beautiful, he told the landlady.
After she had left him alone, Carlos went to the window and lit a cigarette. With his back braced against flowered wallpaper, knees hugged to his chest, he sat and looked across the street at Van Joost's store. His patience was unselfconscious and inexhaustible. No stern exercise of the will gave him that unmoved calm. It came naturally. An oriental trick of passivity in which thoughts and images drifted lazily across the timeless screen of his mind. He was nervous and easily excited, and this ability to assume an animal-like state of quiet was perhaps his most remarkable trait. He never considered it, sitting in the window like an idol carved from dark stone, blue sacrificial cigarette smoke rising in a thin pillar before his face. Van Joost's store looked small, well-kept, like most of the stores on the Cade, and undistinguished. It had nothing unusual about it, standing sturdily in gray Dutch sunlight. It looked all right, but Carlos was considering not entering it. So far, he had followed a simple path. Taking the briefcase had been nearly spontaneous. Even going to Addlegate had been only natural under the circumstances. But now? Now, to visit Van Joost committed him. For a vague promise of future wealth, he would be accepting the risks which men run when they interfere with governments, and he would be accepting those risks blindly, with no knowledge of the countermeasures,
the retaliations which the men concerned with the plans might employ. The wealth which could buy independence was the guiding ambition of his life, but there was nothing suicidal about Carlos. He could still destroy the plans and forget the whole thing. This trip to Holland could be a sailor's quick spree before signing for another voyage. He sat and smoked, immobile in the window, and thoughts and impressions drifted slowly across the unjudging surface of his mind. Clumsy aphorisms formed. It would be good to be wealthy. No sense walking into trouble, no reward without danger. He came to no conscious decision. The decision had been formed days ago in London, years ago in Mexico. He got to his feet and brushed ashes from his jacket. He looked down once more at Juice's store. Then he sighed and went out the door and down the stairs.
"Yes, yes," said Van Juist. "A remarkable man, Mr. Adelgate is. How is Mr. Adelgate these days?"
Van Juist's voice was deep and furry, as though he had not cleared his throat completely. He was a very large man, well over 6 feet tall and proportionately broad, but he gave a fragile impression in spite of his bulk. He had adapted his movements to the size of his shop, and now he minced behind the restricting counter, among the watch movements and trays of trinkets, like a consumptive lion in a cage that mocked his appearance of strength. Juste's hands were large, with blonde hairs growing on the backs. A fine tremor ran through them. He had a habit of staring into Carlos's eyes intently for a second, and then his gaze would dart around the familiar corners of the store. Carlos reacted to nervousness with immobility. He watched Van Juist, wondering what bothered the man.
"It has been, let me see, every bit of 15 years since I have seen Mr. Adelgate. We went into different lines of work, but sometimes we still have the opportunity to send each other customers."
"Yes?"
Carlos said politely.
"Oh, yes."
Juice's hollow laughter with its faint, furry edge boomed across the little store. There was something funny about customers, something amusing about business arrangements. Carlos grinned. He could appreciate the humor of business as well as the next man. He backed a step away from the counter, turning so he could watch the door.
"Now, my friend, Mr....
Yes,"
Carlos said with a fixed and ghastly grin on his face.
"Quite right. Completely right,"
Van Juist said, his laughter loud and edged with weasel fur.
"No names. Only business, am I correct?"
"Only business,"
Carlos said, and they both laughed at the joke. Humor had conquered nervousness. It was hilarious, this matter of business. The tremor increased along Van Juist's hands, and Carlos, laughing, ill at ease, backed another step toward the door. Van Juist took alarm.
"You wish to complete the transaction at once. Excellent. I am authorized, if I might be allowed to look."
An old woman pushed huffily past Carlos and entered the store. Van Juist looked like a man unfairly loaded with responsibilities. He managed to wink at Carlos.
"If you shall wait only one little minute."
I'll come back,
Carlos said. He took a step outside the door. There was a stricken expression on Van Juist's face. He hurried around the counter and took Carlos by the arm.
"Just one moment, my dear friend."
A curtain parted at the rear of the store and two plainclothes detectives came through, their revolvers drawn. They chose to vault spectacularly over the counter. This gave Carlos time to chop Van Juist across the throat with a hand as hard as a piece of seasoned oak. Strangling, Van Juist reeled back into the detectives. The old lady screamed tentatively in recognition of the unusual and not without pleasure. Carlos went through the door like a sprinter, cut through the crowds along De Ruyter's Cade, and vanished into a network of streets at the lower end. The detectives weren't even sure which way he had run. By the time they found out, it was purely an academic question. They gave the alarm, but no alarm had ever outrun Carlos. The ticket clerk had family problems on his mind. He glanced through the bars at the breathless, dark-faced little man. His hands moved automatically toward the reels of tickets.
"Yes?"
he asked, raising his voice above the expiring snarl of a steam train.
"Where do you wish to go?"
When he saw that the man spoke no Dutch, he repeated his question in English, but the man, drenched in perspiration, his black hair plastered against his forehead, evidently didn't understand.
"I want a ticket on the next train,"
Carlos said, striving to control his breathing. The ticket clerk had never heard a language like that. Perhaps it was Basque? Foreigners who expected to be spoken to in their own language should go to the tourist office.
"Where do you wish to go?"
he asked again,
this time in French, speaking very slowly and enunciating with care.
"I want a ticket on the next train,"
Carlos said, this time in Spanish.
"I can't understand what you're saying,"
the ticket clerk said. It was too much, his wife 3 weeks overdue, his mother visiting from Dordrecht, the toilet broken.
"Tell me where you want to go or leave the line."
"I buy a ticket here."
"You're holding up the line. Move or I'll call the police."
Carlos gripped the counter with both hands, glaring at the clerk. The clerk looked across the station, trying to catch the eye of a policeman. A woman tapped Carlos on the shoulder. In the babble of foreign tongues around him, he heard her speak accented but comprehensible English.
"Where do you wish to go?"
"The next train."
"To Paris?"
"Yes."
She told the ticket clerk that the foreigner wanted to go to Paris. Carlos thrust a handful of money across the counter. He received a second-class ticket and a few guilders change. The woman also bought a ticket to Paris and walked with Carlos, half-leading him. She took his arm when he tried to board a first-class compartment, led him firmly but gently to the second class. She was half a head taller than he was, plump with short, silky blonde hair. She was not pretty, but she was also not ugly, and she could speak English. At police headquarters in Amsterdam, two detectives were reduced in rank. A description of the foreigner who had run from Van Joost's store was broadcast to all police units in the city. The charge was suspicion of robbery. A heavy surveillance was put upon the airport and the train station. A report of this was given to Stephen Dane. Later, Dane interrogated Van Joost and found that his description of the man tallied with the description given by Susan Bellows. Joost did not know the man's nationality, had not seen the secrets, had nothing new to add. That was all for nearly 4 hours. Then a frontier guard telephoned. He hadn't received the report in time, but less than half an hour ago he had seen a man answering the thief's description. The man had been driving a tan Volkswagen and had crossed the frontier into Belgium by the Liège Road. Belgium and French police authorities were notified, and border guards from Valenciennes to Esch-sur-Alzette were alerted. An hour later, French police reported that they were holding the driver of the tan Volkswagen at Maubeuge. Dane and Susan Bellows set out at once in an MG loaned to them by the Amsterdam CIA office. Late that afternoon, two Russians with diplomatic passports landed at Amsterdam airport. One of them was tall, young, and very handsome, ascetic and disdainful in appearance. The other man was older, his hair was graying, and his small lips were pursed in amusement at the ephemeral tidiness of the little world around him. Both men gave their occupation as heavy machinery experts. The immigration official wrote it down. These days, all Russians seem to be heavy machinery experts. End of chapter 8.
Chapter 9 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 9. In London that evening, Mr. John Addlegate was turning out the lights in his store preparatory to leaving for his house in Lower Clapton. Since his interview with Dane, he had refused to let himself think. Blindly, automatically, he had gone about his business, his furniture business only. Earlier, before going to Scotland Yard, he had warned his drug contacts to stay away until further notice. Addlegate was taking no chance of trouble. But now the impact of the ordeal was beginning to wear off. He could permit himself to think. He could even congratulate himself on a difficult job boldly and skillfully done. In the normal course of business, he would never have informed Don Carlos, but secrets were not normal business. They were outside the pale of any illegal enterprise he had ever known. Secrets were dangerous. After Carlos left that morning, Addlegate had sat down to think out his own position. He didn't like it. That untutored savage was bound to be caught on the continent, just as a tiger would surely be caught if it tried to roam Hyde Park. Carlos, alone and friendless in the maze of the European underworld, unable to detect friend from informer, deficient in civilized skills, lacking even an intelligible language in which to conduct business, he would be caught. Mr. Addlegate's reasoning had pushed him remorselessly on. After being caught, Carlos would be interrogated, perhaps tortured, certainly tempted. The government men would want to know the names of everyone connected with him, everyone who had had any part in the theft and attempted disposal of the secrets. You could count on them to press very hard. and Carlos, with no motive for loyalty, intent upon saving his own skin, would certainly implicate Attlegate. The possession of those secrets had transformed the man into a sort of plague carrier. Not only would his own liberty be taken away, but the liberty of those who had associated with him. Accordingly, Mr. Attlegate had told the police about Carlos before Carlos had a chance to tell the police about him. All the risks weren't over, but each hour seemed to improve his position. Now the store was in order, and Mr. Attlegate prepared to turn out the lights and go home. As his hand reached for the light switch, he heard a firm knock at the door.
"I'm closed,"
he called out.
"Police,"
a voice answered. Annoyed, Attlegate went to the door and opened it a crack. A large, well-dressed man stood in the evening gloom with two men behind him. The well-dressed man showed a badge attached to a wallet.
"May we come in, sir?"
Attlegate opened the door for them. They filed in, and the last man closed the door behind him. They looked around the shop in a policeman's prying way. Attlegate said,
"I'd like to know..."
"I'm Inspector Haddon. These men are my associates, Detective Sergeants Flynn and Turner."
"I was just going home."
"We'll only detain you for a moment."
Inspector Haddon took a small notebook from his pocket, opened it, and studied a page.
"Now, let me see. About the man."
"Inspector, I told everything I knew at Scotland Yard. My complete testimony is there."
"I realize that, Mr. Attlegate, but you understand how it is. We'd like to double-check all information."
"At this hour?"
"Would it be better if we came during the day when you had customers?"
"No, of course not. What did you wish to know?"
"Just the answers to a few questions. You said that this man offered to sell you secrets. Did you ever actually see these secrets?"
No, sir."
"You're quite sure?"
"Absolutely, I'd remember a thing like that."
"Did he tell you how he came by them?"
No.
"Or what form they were in?"
Attlegate shook his head.
"Would you mind describing the man again?"
Attlegate did so.
"And you're quite sure you could identify him?"
Well, sir.
Now, Mr. Attlegate, you had an excellent look at the man. What's the difficulty?"
Yes, I could identify him."
"You could pick him out of a police lineup?"
"I think I could."
"That's fine," Inspector Haddon said. "That's what we thought."
He nodded, and his two men came up and each held Attlegate by an arm.
"Now, just a moment."
Inspector Haddon wasn't listening. He had turned away and was looking around the shop. After a moment, he walked to a corner where a new shipment of furniture had been unpacked. On top of a pile of cardboard cartons, there was a coil of rope. Haddon picked it up and tested it between his hands.
"Inspector, what is this? What are you people doing?"
Carrying the rope, Haddon walked back to the center of the room. His head was craned back. He was peering at the crossbeams along the ceiling.
"Yes," he said. "That should do nicely."
Attlegate realized what was happening and made a sudden violent effort to break free. The two burly men kept a firm grip on his arms. Haddon pulled a flat-top desk into the middle of the floor. He put a chair on top of it and climbed up. He looped the rope around three crossbeams and tied a knot. Attlegate said,
Mr. Haddon, I was wrong. I can't identify the man."
Standing on the desk, Haddon wiped his hands and began to fashion the free end of the rope into a noose.
You mustn't do this,"
Attlegate shouted.
I can't identify him. Can't possibly."
The men holding him might have been statues. Their faces registered nothing, neither pity nor cruelty. Their thick hands were fixed around his arms as immovably as hands of stone. They stood on either side of him, their feet widely planted, their eyes downcast. Haddon finished his noose, climbed down, and walked over to Attlegate. His well-featured ruddy face had an expression of regret.
"I'm sorry," Haddon said. "This is necessary. I can promise that it won't hurt you."
"You're going to kill me?"
"I'm sorry."
Attlegate screamed.
"What do you mean it won't hurt me? Do you think hanging won't hurt? You can't do it. You promised not to hurt me, Haddon. You promised."
"It won't hurt,"
Haddon said, and moved behind Attlegate. Attlegate wrenched at the stone hands holding him, then sagged suddenly, forcing the men to hold him up. His eyes were fixed on the noose, hypnotized by it. He tried to think of a prayer, but his mind was filled with anger at the unfairness of it all. It wasn't his fault. He wasn't involved. If he could only get loose for a moment, if he could run. Someone, it must have been Haddon, struck him a sharp blow on the back of the neck just under the skull. Adelgate heard a sharp sound like a dry stick breaking. It seemed to him that his store was suddenly plunged into darkness. The fuse must have blown. Simultaneously, the men at his side released their grip. He was free and running. He plunged ahead into the darkness, through the open window into the street. The street lights hadn't been turned on, that was very strange, and the lights of the stores were out. The darkness was absolute, unbroken even by moon or stars overhead. But he could feel the rough pavement under his feet, and he ran, sensing with his feet how the pavement changed to tall grass, and then to soft sand covered with a deepening layer of water. He must have run all the way to Dover. He waded into the water in that split second before he lost consciousness, and he died with the illusion that he was swimming to France and safety. End of chapter 9.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.